This is Monday, the 24th of April, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, there are reports that Russia is arming the Taliban in Afghanistan. The U.S. Defense Secretary is there.
We are going to have to confront Russia where what they're doing is contrary to international law or denying the sovereignty of other countries.
Also ahead, tension increases as U.S. and Japanese ships are en route to waters near North Korea. And the U.S. government faces another possible shutdown at the end of this week. All on today's International Edition. Top U.S. military officials are saying the United States must confront Russia for providing weapons to the Taliban for use against American-backed forces in Afghanistan. At a news conference with Defense Secretary Jim Mattis at his side, General John Nicholson, the American commander in Afghanistan, wouldn't provide any specifics about Russia's role in Afghanistan.
We continue to get reports of this assistance, and of course we had the overt legitimacy lent to the Taliban by the Russians. That really occurred certainly late last year, beginning through this process they've been undertaking. And of course, as the Secretary stated, we support anyone who wants to help us advance the reconciliation process. But arming belligerents or legitimizing belligerents who perpetuate attacks like we saw 2 days ago in Mazar-e-Sharif is not the best way forward to a peaceful reconciliation.
So to be clear, you're not refuting that they're sending weapons to the Taliban?
Oh, no, I'm not refuting that.
U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the U.S. will pursue the reports of Russian involvement.
We will engage with Russia diplomatically. We'll do so where we can. But we are going to have to confront Russia where what they're doing is contrary to international law or denying the sovereignty of other countries, for example. Any weapons being funneled here from a foreign country would be a violation of international law.
Earlier Monday, a senior U.S. military official told reporters in Kabul that Russia was giving machine guns and other medium-weight weapons. Taliban are using the weapons in the southern provinces of Helmand, Kandahar, and Oruzgan, according to the official who briefed journalists on intelligence information on condition of anonymity. Russia is denying that it provides any such support to the Taliban, which ruled Afghanistan until the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. Russia says contacts are limited to safeguarding security and getting the hardline religious fundamentalists to reconcile with the government, which Washington has failed for years to advance. Russia also has promoted easing global sanctions on Taliban leaders who provide cooperation. The Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, has accepted the resignations of the defense minister and army chief of staff following Friday's Taliban attack on a military base that killed more than 100 security force personnel. Defense Minister Abdullah Habibi and army chief of staff Qadam Shah Shahim stepped down with immediate effect. Afghanistan observed a day of national mourning Sunday in the wake of the attack by some 10 militants dressed in army uniforms and driving military vehicles on the base near Mazar-e-Sharif in the north. They used rocket-propelled grenades, rifles, and suicide vests in an hours-long attack on mostly unarmed personnel leaving a mosque after Friday prayers. Let's check in on social media now, see what is happening, see what people are talking about. Andrew Palshevsky is here in his usual slot. What you got today?
Well, some names trending. The first one you may not be familiar with, but a huge accomplishment. Peggy Whitson. She's an American astronaut, and as of today has spent 535 cumulative days in space, more than any other American ever. So a huge accomplishment, and one that I loved this post on social media. Someone put up, one small step for woman, one giant leap for humankind. Of course, echoing those words when Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon.
You wonder how much longer she's going to stay up there, because when she comes back, it could be like a lot of old movies. You know, how many technological advancements have taken place, you know, over the, I mean, she's being informed, obviously, about everything that's going on, but still, and also the weight of gravity. once you get out of there. You know, that's nothing to overlook.
Yeah, I think it was Scott Kelly, the astronaut, who said when he came back, it takes a while for you to get your kind of legs back because they do atrophy. You have to keep them moving. You see the astronauts on the bicycles, the recumbent bicycles up there in the space station. But talk about the technology down here. Talk about the technology up there. You know, Peggy Whitson in a video chat with President Trump talking about some of the technology they have up there, including, she says that because water is such a scarcity, they're working on ways to convert urine into drinkable water. And she said, it's not as bad as it sounds, trust me. And President Trump responded, he said, better you than me.
Yeah.
A lot of people responding to that on social media with one word, ew.
Yeah. That's Andrew Palshevsky with a look at some of what is happening on social media. A little short on time today. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Greatly appreciated. This is International Edition. Among the top stories today, France's two contenders for the presidency launched their campaigns today. President Trump has again made separate telephone calls from the White House to the leaders of Japan and China to discuss concerns about North Korea. Days after the brazen Taliban attack on the Afghan military base, top U.S. military officials are not refuting reports that Russia has been arming the insurgent group. President Trump is facing Democratic opposition as he makes a new push for construction of a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. And former U.S. President Barack Obama returned to public life today, meeting with college students in his adopted hometown of Chicago to urge them to be activists in their communities, much like he was before he ran for public office. More on these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The two survivors of Sunday's presidential election in France launched their campaigns Monday in a frantic bid to garner an absolute majority in a runoff election scheduled for May 7th. The choice for the voters will be either staying the course in the European Union or possibly Great Britain's Brexit. Joining us from London is VOA chief European correspondent Luis Ramirez. Luis, many are comparing the choice faced by the French voters with the choice of voters here in the United States between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Is that a fair comparison?
It is and it isn't. It is in the sense that very much it's the anti-establishment sentiments among French voters that are driving this election. And it is not because what French voters have in this case done is they've chased out the mainstream parties. This is the first time in the history of the Fifth Republic set up by Charles de Gaulle that the at least one of the mainstream parties is not taking part in elections. So that is in itself a revolution that goes beyond what we saw in the United States, where Donald Trump was elected as a member of the Republican Party.
What is the importance of this election, not just to France, but to the rest of the world? Obviously, the European Union might be concerned.
Well, that is a big issue because essentially the choice before French voters in the final round on May 7th will be ultimately whether France stays in the European Union or not. Marine Le Pen has made a departure from the European Union one of the cornerstones of her campaign. She very firmly says Brussels has no business dictating immigration policy to France, and immigration is what's driving many of the people who are voting for her. While Emmanuel Macron is very much a centrist. He is very pro-EU, pro-business. He thinks that globalization has worked just fine for France and thinks it's the best way forward. So when people vote on May 7th, they'll essentially be voting on France's place in the EU.
What do you read as the sociological or other implications or situations among the French voters and in France which led to the selection of these two candidates?
Well, you have a very big split among voters. I think where you have them, let's start with what they have in common. What they have in common is that they are all tired of the system, that something about the current set of politicians has gone wrong for France in terms of jobs, in terms of economic growth. Now, you look at the numbers, France has one of Europe's highest unemployment rates, more than 10% annually. This is compared to Germany, which is doing much better, and certainly, you know, neighbors like Luxembourg doing, in fact, receiving French workers who can't find jobs in France. And so you've got that, plus you add to that the issue of security. France has seen a string of terrorist attacks since, 2015, Charlie Hebdo, then the Paris attacks in November of that year. Last year they had the truck attack in Nice, in Normandy. Just a few days before these elections, the Champs-Élysées shooting, in which one policeman died. So you've got a sense of frustration over the economy, frustration over security, fueling people to vote for Marine Le Pen, and essentially against the establishment. On the other hand, there is a concern that Marine Le Pen's message is smacks of xenophobia. She very much is opposed to any continued massive immigration, especially from Muslim countries. That doesn't sit well among especially urbanites, middle and upper middle class urbanites, who say, well, France is cosmopolitan and they could not be brought to vote for Le Pen.
What is your view of the voter makeup? Is it mostly urban, or is there a mix like it is here in the United States of urban and rural?
It is most definitely a mix, and the only thing that could bring Marine Le Pen, after all, she did come in second in this first round, that could win her the presidency ultimately, is whether she manages to convince more people than she has already, who sit on the left, former unionists who are frustrated over job losses, and people who would have normally voted socialist, how many people she can convince, that will determine whether she in fact makes it. Right now, the polls are very much speaking against it. I know there's a great deal of skepticism on polls. Certainly, they were wrong in the United States. They were wrong in Britain when Brexit came. But in this case, in France, they happen to be right. The polls predicted that Macron and Le Pen would both make it to the final round.
Luis Ramirez, VOA's chief European correspondent, joining us. Thanks again, Luis. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
Up next on International Edition, the U.S. government is facing another possible shutdown at the end of this week. Stay with us for that. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The U.S. federal government budget awaits members of Congress as they return to Capitol Hill this week. Funding to run the government will run out Friday night if a spending agreement isn't reached before then. As VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman explains to VOA's Jim Stevenson, there is ample disagreement on spending issues, even though both chambers of Congress and the White House are Republican-held.
Jim, Congress is returning from a two-week recess, and there are many things that congressional Republicans and the White House would like to tackle, such as tax reform and perhaps taking another crack at repealing Obamacare. But there is something much more urgent on their plate for this week at least, and that is the fact that federal spending authority, in other words, federal funding, expires on Friday. And unless Congress authorizes new spending, there will be a partial shutdown of the federal government. Essentially, non-essential services will end. Those federal employees who are deemed non-essential will be told to go home. Jim, this sounds awfully familiar to you and I.
You and I have been here long enough to witness a few of these and the effects of them, which actually have been different each time it has happened. This go-around is very interesting because we're in the very early phases of a new administration, and what effects that might have on the White House and also the Republican Party have yet to be seen, obviously.
Jim, we are coming up on the 100-day mark of the Trump administration, and he would be the first president to preside over a federal shutdown this early in his administration. Typically, these things happen later on. And it is rather striking because, of course, Donald Trump is a Republican, and Republicans control both houses of Congress. What is needed is a spending bill, and spending bills cannot be filibustered. In other words, minority Democrats, even if they wanted to, could not on their own block a Republican spending bill. As long as Republicans have the majority votes in both houses of Congress to pass this bill, and as long as Donald Trump is willing to sign it. So in essence, Republicans hold all the cards, but it's not entirely clear that Republicans are going to be unified behind a spending bill. And this is where the drama comes in. Donald Trump wants a sort of initial down payment for constructing or actually expanding the existing border wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. There are a number of other sort of potentially difficult spending issues that have to be overcome. But the big one is what happens with this border wall. Democrats are absolutely opposed to it. If there is even a cent of money, one U.S. cent of money to construct this border wall, Democrats are not going to vote for the spending bill. But there are also a number of Republicans who are somewhat uncomfortable with this idea, or who at least think that this is a fly in the ointment, and that at a time of pressing international concerns from Syria to North Korea and beyond, that this is not the time to be dabbling or to be inviting any sort of breakdown in the federal government.
This is a bit unusual because the president in power usually has the backing of his party, at least early on.
This is something that we have witnessed going back to the campaign, that a lot of what Donald Trump stands for and a lot of what he says causes a certain amount of heartburn and indigestion within his own political party. Here's what's likely to happen. We don't know if what actually materializes between now and Friday is some kind of stopgap spending bill. Congress is very good at that, putting off difficult decisions, extending funding for another few months.
Even years.
Kicking the can down the road and giving themselves a chance to negotiate a larger, grander deal and to presumably come up with the unity that would be required to do this. That is one possibility. There is a thought among Republicans that if they are going to bite this apple, which is border wall construction, that maybe that should be something that should be done for the next fiscal year, give themselves a chance to come up with some sort of unified position on it, if in fact a unified position is there to be had.
Above all the fiscal hawks and policy hawks is our media hawk on the Hill, Michael Bowman, who presides over the Senate. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
As we continue, tensions are again flaring up between the United States and North Korea as concerns grow that the communist state will celebrate another important national holiday with a nuclear test or an intercontinental ballistic missile. On the eve of the 85th anniversary of the founding of the North Korean People's Army, there are reports of renewed activity at the North Korea nuclear test site, although analysts caution it is unclear whether a test is imminent. Meanwhile, two Japanese destroyers joined a military exercise with the USS Carl Vinson Carrier Strike Group en route to the Korean Peninsula region. South Korea said on Monday it was in talks with Washington about holding its own joint drills with the U.S. Naval Strike Force. North Korea Sunday responded defiantly to the renewed U.S. military show of force, saying it is combat ready to sink a U.S. nuclear-powered aircraft carrier with a single strike. That was a commentary in the North's ruling Workers' Party Rodong Sinmun newspaper. This is VOA's International Edition. A pet can provide comfort and companionship for an elderly person or someone who is disabled. And VOA's Deborah Block tells us more about it.
This cute animal isn't your average pet. Its name is Miro, a robot designed to be a companion. Its creator, Consequential Robotics, thinks the machine could be especially useful for the elderly or people with disabilities.
As you can see, you can't really tell if it's a dog or a sheep or a cow. It's a hybrid animal. It has a companionship effect, so when it's on and around you, it really gives you that warm, buzzy feeling that you have someone that understands you, and it kind of really can help for loneliness, but also autism, people with learning disability.
Miro is fitted with sensors that recognize when its head or back is being stroked, and it responds by wagging its tail. It has a sonar sensor in its nose that senses its location and stereo cameras built into its eyes that can identify people and follow their movements. And thanks to artificial intelligence, Miro is smarter than the average pet.
With artificial intelligence, it opens doors to a whole range of new things. If it was just an animal, you would be pretty much stuck at that animal level, that ability to interact emotionally. But since we have the artificial level and that high-level thinking brain, we can do things which animals couldn't.
Like making phone calls, recognizing visitors at the door, and reminding people of their plans for the day. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
A little too creepy for me. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, the inimitable Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day. It is an occasion to recognize the global effort to effectively control and eventually wipe out this terrible disease. This year's theme is End Malaria for Good. In 2015, 212 million people became sick with malaria, and over 429,000 died. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that 90% of malaria cases were reported in Africa, as were 92% of malaria-related deaths. The good news is malaria is preventable and curable, and there is good reason to believe that we can eliminate it altogether. Indeed, between 2000 and 2015, when the international community intensified its efforts, new cases among populations at risk fell by 29% globally. Nonetheless, a child still dies from malaria every 2 minutes. That is why we continue to focus on prevention. Among the most successful weapons we have against this deadly disease are insecticide-treated nets and indoor spraying with insecticides to kill the mosquitoes that carry the illness-causing parasite. These preventive tools, when coupled with strategies to prevent malaria during pregnancy, low-cost diagnostic tools, and highly effective malaria treatments, have and will continue to dramatically reduce death and disease from malaria. Yet much more needs to be done. To address remaining challenges, including the emergence of drug-resistant malaria, the World Health Organization has developed the Global Technical Strategy for Malaria, which provides a technical framework for all endemic countries as they work towards control and elimination. The first goals to be reached by the year 2020 are to reduce malaria incidence by at least 40%, reduce malaria mortality rates by at least 40%, eliminate the disease in at least 10 countries, and prevent a resurgence of malaria in all countries that are malaria-free. If we are to be successful, donors must step up to help fund the effort. The United States is the largest donor to malaria control and elimination programs, contributing over 50% of all donor funding available to countries for implementation. Still, if the 2020 targets of the Global Technical Strategy are to be achieved, total funding must increase substantially. On this day, we call on our friends and partners around the globe to contribute to the funds to help roll back and eventually eliminate this awful disease once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.